You can be turned to Luke chapter 16. How often have you ever had that thought, if I could go back and do it again? If I only knew then what I know now, right? That's what we say sometimes. Have you ever thought about what you'd do if you could go back to, say, school with everything you know now about how life works? What would be different? Maybe would you study harder about some things? Would you not worry about some things? Would you avoid some trouble? Would you stand up to somebody? Would you ask somebody out? What would be different if you could go back and do it all over again knowing what you know now? Would you try to be a better friend to somebody? Would you be more vocal about your faith? Would you warn somebody about the direction their life is going, knowing now, knowing then what you know now about how things turn out? What would you do if you could go back? Well, we can't. But that same kind of aching regret is at the heart of this account of the rich man Lazarus. Because the rich man's going to have this realization that he can't go back. But he's going to wish that he could send somebody back to tell his brother something very important that he's understood and realized too late. And that's a terrifying thought. It's one of the most terrifying things to me is this idea of realizing too late. And that's really at the heart of this parable, and this account, I should say. We'll talk about whether it's a parable or not in just a moment. But this account of the rich man and Lazarus here in chapter 16. This is a fascinating and somewhat perplexing. One of the questions is the nature of it anyway, as I just mentioned. I had that right at the beginning, but I moved it to the end because it's not really that important. It doesn't really change what Jesus is telling us. It's one of the passages we go to, though, when we want to learn about what happens when we die. That's often the time when we go to the rich man Lazarus, when we're looking at that. Although I don't believe that's really Jesus' main point here. But there are definitely, it gives us some glimpses, it gives us some information, and there's only a few passages that do give us some insight into, some clues into what happens when we die, and this is one of them. And so that's usually what kind of catches our eye about it. But I don't believe that's really Jesus' main point. And so I first want to just go through and look at the account itself, the record, and then we'll look at some applications that we can make of it for ourselves. First of all, let's think about the context. What is the context of this teaching? Well, it would appear that to me, as I was just scanning back up through the chapter, that it's probably related to something that is said in up beginning in verse 14. Jesus has just finished the parable of the unjust steward. And at the close of that parable of the unjust steward, notice the Pharisees' reaction, verse 14. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things and they ridiculed him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God." So the Pharisees loved money. Now it doesn't say they were rich, but do you have to be rich to love money? You don't have to be rich to love money. In fact, usually in Jewish society, those who were of the upper echelon, the ruling class, as I understand it, mostly were Sadducees. The Pharisees were more like what we would probably think of as middle class, as I understand it. But they loved money, and money was very important to them. And so Jesus says here, you've got things out of kilter. The thing that you hold up as very important is an abomination to God. God sees things differently than you do. And I think that's at the core of this account of the rich man Lazarus. Now, what's interesting is if it just flowed straight from there to that, we would know that's the context. But actually, in between, there are some other teachings that seem a little bit unrelated. There's one about the nature of the old law and not a dot would pass away. And then there's a teaching about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, all right there in the next couple of verses. And then he starts with the rich man Lazarus. But it does look like it's part of the same teaching. It's part of the same instruction, part of the same discourse. And so I would suggest that probably that gives us a clue as to the context with that little bit there about the Pharisees loving money. And the fact that what they exalt is what God finds abominable. So now with that in mind, let's go down and introduce the characters. Really, they're the two main characters in this teaching are introduced to us in the first two verses. There was a rich man, verse 19, who was clothed in purple and fine linen, who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. So there's two people. There's a rich man. And we're told some things about this man. Really, there's only three details we can pull out of this. First of all, we can notice later, just as a passing thing, that Lazarus sat by his gate. And so he had a gated house. He was very wealthy. But really, the focus on the description of him is in his clothes and his food. He wore the finest of clothing. It is said that he wore, he was clothed in purple and fine linen. The kind of thing that only a wealthy person could afford. And maybe some people who might have that kind of clothing, but they would save it for special occasions. This guy probably dressed like that all the time because he was just that wealthy. And it says he feasted sumptuously every day. Now that would really mean something to these people. Feasts were something that were on special occasions for a celebration. You didn't just kill the fatted calf for any reason. Remember the older brother, just the previous chapter, when he comes home and says, what's going on? They killed a fatted calf. He said, I've been here all these years. You've never killed a fatted calf for me. So that was a very, very special thing to have a feast, to have a celebration. Everyday people could do that, but it would be on the occasion of like a wedding. Or it would be on the occasion of when the harvest came in. Maybe once a year you would have a feast. But imagine this description of a man who feasts sumptuously every day. I mean, every day, every evening when he sits down to eat, every day when he sits down to eat, it's a feast. And so that's the kind of wealth that he had. In contrast to that, we have the poor man who is described there as lying at his gate and covered in sores. It is interesting that whereas the rich man wears the finest linen and purple, the poor man, we're not told about his clothing, we're told he's covered in sores. So the contrast is almost between covered in fine linen and covered in sores. He's clothed with sores. Most of the time, when you find someone who is begging in the New Testament, they have some kind of infirmity and some kind of a physical disability, especially men. It was just expected you would work if you could. And so usually when we find somebody begging, it's somebody who's blind or somebody who has lame or somebody who has leprosy. And being covered in sores makes me think of leprosy, but usually lepers are called lepers. And so perhaps he didn't have leprosy, but he had some kind of a disease. And apparently this kept him from being able to work. Even as I was looking for images to use, a lot of the pictures that people, paintings that people made of this, have him with some crutches beside him. But the text doesn't say, but it's just assumed there was some reason why he wasn't able to get out and work like everybody else. And so his only way of surviving is to just lay by this man's gate. And there he is, covered in sores, and he's poor. And we're told something about his food as well. It says, verse 21, he desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. This is not even asking for leftovers. It would be something to say, could I have, you know, when you're done with that, could I have what's left on your plate? Some people would gladly do that. Some people would be glad to eat what you throw away when we go to a restaurant. You know, and there's still some food there. There's people that would be glad to have that. But he's not even asking for that. What he longs for, what he craves is the stuff that fell off the table onto the floor. So imagine how hungry you would have to be when you would be craving the crumbs that you see that fall. So as this rich man's feasting every day and he's having everything he could possibly want, inevitably there's little bitty pieces of stuff that falls on the floor, falls between the cracks, or falls off the edge of the table, or falls off him when he stands up. And this guy would be grateful to be able to go in and have that to eat because he doesn't have anything. And it's interesting that it says he longed, in the New American Standard, in the NIV, it said he longed for those. And that even creates, you know, when you have a longing, that implies that you don't have it. And so the implication that I get is that he's outside the gate. He's not welcome. He's not brought in. And being outside the gate, he longs for the crumbs, but he doesn't even have the crumbs. Because if he was given that all the time, why he would long for it or crave for it. So this is something that he wishes he could have. So he doesn't even have as good as the crumbs that are falling off of the rich man's plate. Or perhaps he gets them once in a while. And maybe he just lays there all the time hoping that maybe they will give them to him, they would let him have them. We also can notice as we think about these two, their company. We're not told anything about the rich man's company, but just knowing what we know from other rich people in the Bible, and you know, when you're wealthy, a lot of times you have lots of friends. And feasting sumptuously, probably not alone. Probably had his buddies over who he, you know, feasted with. Meanwhile, what are we told about the company for the poor man, Lazarus? We're told that the dogs licked his sores. And realize that in the Jewish mind, dogs weren't like dogs like are to us today. I mean, we love dogs. And, dogs are family, and dogs are, you know, pets, and dogs are, you know, things like that. But in their world, dogs were mongrels, and they were, you know, they just wandered around, strays, and they just ate carcasses and stuff. And so they didn't see dogs like we do, as, you know, being pets. So the idea of laying there and having these dogs licking you into the Jewish mind, it may not have been as low as the prodigal son when he's feeding the pigs and wishing he could eat what they eat. As far as being unclean, I don't know that it would have been quite that bad as far as how this would, the Jews would react to somebody. But I think it would be in that category. I think it would be in that neighborhood. The way they would look at somebody who is, as you walk by that person and there's dogs licking some sores on him, to them that would be just absolutely, grotesque and unclean, for these dogs to be licking you. And so that's kind of the picture of these two and how their lives pass, how their days pass. Until one day, verse 22 tells us, the poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side, and the rich man also died and was buried. Isn't that interesting? In one verse, they both died. And that's one of those just facts of life that maybe it's good to be reminded of. Everybody dies. Back in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, we're told, it's the same for all. Since the same event happens to the righteous, the wicked, the good, the evil, the clean, the unclean, him who sacrifices, him who does not sacrifice, as the good one is, so is the sinner, as he who swears, he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun. The same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. Solomon's kind of struggling with that. He struggled with the fact that it doesn't really matter what you do, you die. That you could live by the rules and die. You can flaunt the rules and die. You can be rich and die poor. It doesn't really matter. That's one thing that kind of levels the playing field. And that's exactly what happens here to our two men, the rich man and Lazarus, is that after time passes, they both die. But this is where things change dramatically in as far as what happens. And notice what happens at death. As soon as they die, we're told the poor man died and was carried by angels to Abraham's side. Isn't that a comforting thought? We're told the rich man died and was buried and opened his eyes in Hades. So upon death, immediately circumstances change for these two. The poor man is carried by angels to Abraham's side, and the rich man, it says in verse 23, in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus at his side. Now the tables are turned, and it's time for the rich man to beg. Verse 24, he calls out, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame. I noticed that twice he asked Abraham to send Lazarus on an errand. And I wondered whether he still yet got it. I don't know. But it's almost as if he still sees Lazarus as somebody to be sent after on something. Hey, send Lazarus to go get some water. But then I thought about that. I also realized he's asking to have that water from Lazarus' finger drip on his tongue. And I can guarantee you, in this man's life, he would never have touched Lazarus, much less drank a drop of water off of his finger. Lazarus was dirty. He probably smelled bad. Dogs licked him. And yet now, when this man's in torment, he would be glad to have a drop of water drip off of Lazarus' finger onto his tongue, because that's the kind of torment that he is in. How things have changed. But Abraham answered in verse 25. Abraham said, Child, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. This is a theme of Jesus' teaching. Very often Jesus will say something like, the first will be last, and the last will be first. And it's this idea that the way things are now isn't the way they're always going to be. Things are going to change. There's things now that are out of kilter, but they will be made right. And there's no comfort now for this rich man. And besides that, Abraham says it's not really within his power to grant his request. Look at verse 26. Besides all this, he says, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, nor and none may cross from there to us. He says there's been a chasm has been fixed. What does that tell you? Somebody put it there. Right? Who put it there? God did. And Abraham's saying, things have been set so that there is no crossing back and forth. There's nobody going to you from us, and there's nobody coming to us from you. That's the way that it is, and we'll come back to that in a moment. These two groups are permanently separated. Since he couldn't then have this request for himself, the rich man, first thing he thinks of is how his own torment, as anybody would. But then he begins to think, when he realizes the now it sinks in, apparently, that he's stuck here. And he starts to think about people who haven't yet died. He starts to think about his family, his brothers, who are still alive and who are inevitably headed for a similar fate, but maybe they can be convinced to change. And so he says in verse 27, then I beg you, Father. Isn't that interesting? He's begging now. I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house. For I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment. He's just sure somebody can warn his brothers and they will not have to be there with him. And there's a side point we could note. Nobody would want anybody to come join them in torment, would they? And so he wants them to go back and warn his brothers. Tell them so they won't be here with me. But Abraham's answer is very important. Look at verse 29. Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. Now, where's Moses? Moses and the prophets are over there with Abraham. Literally, right? I mean, they're dead. So what does he mean? He's talking about their writings. He's saying they have Moses and the prophets. In other words, they have the scriptures. What he's basically saying is they have their Bibles. And the rich man says, oh, that's not going to do any good. Look at what he says. He doesn't have any faith at all in that plan. Verse 30, he said, no, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. He says, I don't really have any faith in this. They've got Abraham and the prophet, Moses and the prophets. But if you send somebody back, they'll repent. Now notice Abraham's response. He said to him, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. That's kind of hard to swallow, isn't it? I mean, sometimes we think, oh man, if we could see miracles today, I wish we could see me. If God would just show me something, then I would know what I was supposed to do. And people will say those kinds of things. Well, if we had the miracles, it's really not fair. We don't have miracles like they had miracles. Abraham says, if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they wouldn't listen even if somebody rose from the dead. So we'll come back to that in a moment and talk about what that means. You can be thinking on it for the next few moments. So let's think of some applications of this. That is the teaching. That is the account. Now, as I said, the first one I want to talk about is the nature of the afterlife. Very often when we come to this passage, we are coming to it to see what we can learn about what happens when we die. And one of the issues that comes up is, what kind of teaching is this that Jesus is giving here? Is he describing literal things? Is he describing real things? Is it a parable, some would say? Some would say that it is a parable. And it is, I will say, in a section of passages that's one parable after another. You go back to chapter 14, it's parable after parable after parable. All of chapter 15, parable, parable, parable. The first thing in chapter 16 is the parable of the unjust steward, and it begins the same way. A rich man did this and did this. And then you come down to this verse, a rich man did this and did this. And so it just seems like it fits into that mold. However, the thing that is very unusual about it is that we have a man named Lazarus. And when Jesus is telling his parables, it's always a sower went out to sow. And it's not a sower named Simon went out to sow. It's just a sower went out to sow. And so the parables are always these anonymous kind of, you know, it's kind of like if you're telling a story, and if I said to you, a little boy and his grandfather were sitting on the dock and they were, you know, talking, you would know I'm probably telling you a made-up story. We do that all the time. We have these illustrations, you know what I mean? But if I said to you, a little boy named Frank Thomas was sitting with his grand, you'd probably think, well, this is a real story because I gave you his name, right? And so very often people will say, and in fact, in my Bible, it says all throughout this chapter, the parable of the parable of the parable. But when it comes to this, it just says the rich man and Lazarus. It does not call it a parable. And many people would say it is not a parable. I would say it doesn't really matter. And that's why I moved this point to the end. Because Jesus' parables are all based in reality. I can't think of any exceptions to that. When he talks about the sower, when he talks about the, he always uses things that exist to describe and make a spiritual point. And so it would be hard for me to imagine that Jesus is just going to invent things out of whole cloth that don't exist to make a point. It seems far more likely to me that Jesus is going to use things, realities to make this spiritual point. But there's some debate about that. There's some question about that, and you can study and you can decide for yourself, which it is. I do think at the same time that there are some things about this that almost have to be figurative. For instance, we know that when you die, the soul leaves and the body is buried in the ground. And there's going to be a resurrection one day when the tombs will be emptied. But in the meantime, and that's what we're talking about, where people are in the meantime. In the meantime, the soul is separated from the body. Paul describes it as being unclothed and longing to be clothed with a new heavenly body. And so this spirit that has been disembodied, we would not imagine to have things like eyes and fingers and tongues, and yet that's what's described here, that he lifted up his eyes and he felt this heat from these flames, which are all earthly physical things, and he asked for water to be dripped on his tongue, and probably, I'm just saying probably, these are figurative, probably earthly concepts to help us grasp a spiritual reality that may be beyond our ability to comprehend because we don't have anything to compare it to. And so it would, I'm just throwing that out there for your consideration, that a lot of the descriptions of heaven, streets of gold, gates of pearl, these are things where the Lord uses earthly things that we can relate to and then uses them to paint a picture of spiritual realities that is probably different, but we just probably don't have any way to even comprehend. So I'm just throwing all that out there for you as far as when we consider this teaching about what's going on here is when people in this waiting place. Well, of course, what we're talking about too is the realm of the dead. Hades is this idea of the realm of the dead. And the picture that Jesus paints is that in between, after somebody dies and before the resurrection, that there's this realm of the dead, Hades, and that in that there's two areas. There's one which is described as Abraham's side. It's sometimes described as paradise. Remember what Jesus said to the thief on the cross? Today, you'll be with me in paradise today. And then later he came back to earth. So somewhere in between his dying and his resurrection, he went to paradise and he was there with the thief on the cross. And so there's a place that in this teaching is described as by Abraham's side and is a place of comfort. And then there's another description of this place of torment. And so that's the picture that is painted here. It raises some difficulties because it for one thing, it presumes that you're already judged in a sense because then you have to wonder what's the judgment day about. Also, you've got this conversation going back and forth. And we would wonder, well, are there like, is everybody yelling back and forth all the time? Even now, are there millions of people shouting back and forth? So there's some things about that are difficult, you know, that make me pause about saying that I could be adamant or dogmatic. This is describing a literal thing that's exactly what we should expect as soon as we open our eyes after we die. I just don't know. But I do think that Jesus is trying to make some very important points that we can be absolutely sure about. And that discussion is almost a distraction away from the truths that are here. So let's look at some of those. What are some of the truths that are absolutely clear regardless of those other kind of questions? Notice the first one is that the tables will be turned. He said back up in the context in verse 15, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. What's exalted among men is an abomination to God, in the sight of God. In human eyes, the rich man's got it all. And think about this from the perspective of Pharisees who love money. Here's a guy that feasts every day. He wears the finest of clothing. I mean, they would have thought, this guy has got it figured out. He's blessed. He's smart. He's successful. This is what life's all about. Getting, that's where I want to be. It's kind of like if you drive through one of those neighborhoods and you just wonder, how do people get here? What do you have to do to get to there? Like, if I could get to here, I'd be somebody. You know what I mean? If I could live, wow, what did they do? What path did he take through life that led him to this? You know, and there's an earthly sense that we look at that and we say, that's success. That's what it's about. That's good. And Jesus is saying, you know, God sees things differently than you do. God doesn't hold the same things up as being wonderful as people hold up as being wonderful. In fact, it's often the opposite way around. In God's eyes, God looks at the heart. Remember, notice what Jesus says there in verse 15. But God knows your hearts. So God looks inside these two men. He looks straight past the sores and the dogs licking and all that, and he sees his heart. And he looks right through the fine clothing, and he sees his heart. And what God sees is the opposite of what man sees. The Jews would have saw this guy that's laying down. They would have thought there's something wrong with him. And he's to be, you know, pushed aside. He's untouchable. He's dirty. He's, you know, beneath us. He's low class. And we shouldn't have anything to do with him. And so we want to have something to do with these guys. And James warns about it, even when somebody comes into your assembly and somebody comes in and they're like, you know, poor and all that. Do you kind of like, politely shuffle them off to the side, and somebody else comes in and they're very successful and sharp looking and all that? Do you kind of run up to them? Because we have to fight this urge to judge by appearance. We really have to struggle against that, because it can come really easy to us if we're not careful. When we see somebody who's begging, we see somebody who's homeless, we see somebody who's poor, we see somebody who's in a hard time, and we think, well, they must have done something to put themselves there. They must not have, you know, they must be a sorry person, or else look what's happened to them. Or we see somebody who's successful and think, wow, this guy, he must be really smart. He must be really good because he's doing really... If we're not careful, we'll make the exact same mistake that these people did in judging these people by their situations in life and not realize that God sees straight through to their hearts. I think that's something that we can... a lesson we can learn from that. Notice what Jesus said earlier in the same book. He said to them, take care, be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. He said, be careful who you're jealous of. That was one of the proverbs from our class Wednesday night. Be careful about being jealous of the wealthy, jealous of the worldly, jealous of the sinners, jealous of the rich people, and think, hey, they've got it. I wish I had what they have. Be careful, Jesus says. Life's not about how much stuff you've got. And that's an important lesson for us to realize as well. And I think we ought to think, put ourselves in the rich man's shoes and realize there's a danger in neglecting people who are in need and who like this poor man. That's apparently one of the things that got this rich man in trouble. When I was in college at Freed Hardeman, one of the Bible professors one week dressed up like a homeless person. I saw somebody posted a similar thing on Facebook recently, where somebody did that, but this was way before that. And so I can't remember how many days, but he kind of sat around on campus for a while and, just in a total disguise, like a homeless person. And to my knowledge, I don't think I ever ran across him. But if I did, I just didn't even notice him. But I don't remember if I ever saw him or not. But I remember he got up for chapel one day. It was all because he was down to do the chapel talk. And he got up for chapel and revealed that it was he who had been sitting out in the commons area, you know, in this homeless getup. And he did it just to see how the students there would treat him. You know, here's a whole school of Christians, supposed to be. And so how would they treat a homeless person sitting on campus? And it's almost not fair in a way, because, you know, you're rushing from class to class and all that. But at the same time, you know, we have to ask, do we notice people that are in need, or do we just look right past them and look over them and not even pay attention because we've got our own friends and we got our own thing going on? So it's a good checking. You know, I think we ought to check ourselves, because this God saw Lazarus and he knew his situation. He took care of him. And remember what Jesus says in Matthew 25, I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was thirsty and you didn't give me anything to drink. I was in prison, you didn't come. I was naked, you didn't give me any clothes. And they said, when, Lord? Because apparently they went through their whole life and never noticed. So we need to be aware of people around us. And then I would also say along these same lines that we should recognize about ourselves that just because things are going super great for us now doesn't mean we're necessarily right with God. And just because things are going hard for us in this life doesn't mean something's wrong. It may be our lot in life to suffer. We may never be in the big house. Or you might be in the back house. It doesn't matter. Those things are irrelevant as far as how your soul is with God. And so if it is our lot to suffer, to be sick, to be have covered in sores, to lose everything and be dirt poor and be on the street, it doesn't mean God's abandoned you. It doesn't mean that you're not right with God. It doesn't mean you don't have a hope of heaven. Or if you're living the most comfortable life anybody has ever lived, that doesn't mean you've got something comforting waiting later. What we need to be concerned about is how does our heart stand with God, and that's not determined by the amount of our possessions. I think another point of this that is emphasized is what Abraham says when he tells the rich man that there's a great gulf fixed and no one can cross from one side to the other. Oh, I meant to have that picture on the previous point. No one can cross, he says. There's a teaching, I think if I understand the Catholic idea of purgatory, which I haven't studied in depth, but if I understand it, Catholics, saved people, Christians, who sin, if they're not forgiven in this life, will have to go to purgatory for some period of time to pay for their sins. And so the amount of time you spend in purgatory depends on how bad you've been. And you can avoid that by doing penance now, and that's why they do confession and those kinds of things. And so they would teach that there will be people who will go into torment or into what they call purgatory, and you'll spend some time there, and when you've done your time, when you've paid for your crimes, you'll be welcomed into heaven. Now let me tell you, I can tell you where that doctrine came from. That came from the thoughts of man, because that sounds like a good idea to me. Doesn't it sound like a good idea to you? I mean, I would like it if it was true. Selfishly. Because then you would think, wow, well, if you kind of mess up, if you, if you don't do things right or whatever, you just go do your time and it'll be awful, but it'll be over and then things will be okay and you'll go on to heaven and you'll forget about all that. That is nowhere in Scripture. There's not a hint of that I can find in the Bible. That people go into torment for a little while and then they're let out. Instead, specifically, Abraham says, there is a gulf fixed between here and there, and nobody comes. And even though that's in this waiting place, there's no indication later when Jesus says, like in Matthew 25, the sheep, he said, go to my right and the goats to my left, and this is like eternal. That's it. There's no indication that there's anything temporary about it. The pictures that are painted for us are that once you die, your destiny is fixed. Now, where you can change it is while you're alive. And that's what the Scriptures make clear. That we have this whole life to choose. And we might be going this way and we could turn and go this way. And then we go in that way and we could turn and go back this way. But we get to decide. But when we die, that's when it's over. And when they died, one went here, one went there. And he says there's no going back and forth. And that is terrifying. But the good news is we're all still alive. Everybody sitting here is alive, and everybody sitting here can decide right now, I'm going to serve God. So I can go into comfort. I can go into the paradise. I can go and ultimately be in heaven with him. The rich man understood this eventually, and he wanted his brothers to change so they wouldn't come be with him. And that brings us to probably the most important point of the lesson. I think Jesus usually drives home his teachings with getting at the heart of it. And he gets at the heart of it here when he says, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. He says, no, Father Abraham, but you send back somebody from the dead and they'll listen. He said, if they won't listen to Moses and the prophets, they wouldn't listen even if somebody rose from the dead. Now I asked you earlier, that seems strange, right? Is it true though? Were there people who still didn't believe in Jesus after he came back from the dead? Were there people who were there when Lazarus came out of the tomb that still didn't believe? In fact, there were people when Lazarus came walking out of the tomb who ran and told the Pharisees and leaders about it, and they decided they were going to kill him. He came back from the dead, they still didn't believe. The miracles supported the teaching, but what changes people's hearts was always the message. It was their revelation. And even when they did miracles, it was to support the message, but the message was never the miracle. The faith wasn't in the miracle. The faith is always in the message. And you can just look at that. Even for instance, turn to Luke 24. If you're still there in Luke 16, turn over to chapter 24. This is after Jesus rose from the dead. And he walks along with these two men from Emmaus. In verse 27, it says, beginning with Moses and the prophets. Isn't that what Abraham just said? They have Moses and the prophets. It says, beginning with Moses and the prophets, he, that is Jesus, interpreted to them all the scriptures in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Here's Jesus. He'd come back from the dead. And he's appearing to these two men. And what does he use to create faith in them? Hey, look, I'm alive. I was dead, but I'm... No. He says, don't you know what the scriptures say? And he went through the scriptures. Because faith is based on God's revelation. You go over to Acts chapter 2, and Peter says, hey, we're standing here as witnesses of Jesus' resurrection. Now, let me tell you what the Bible says about that. Joel says, and David said, and Moses said. So even though they were eyewitnesses of the resurrection, what they preached was the word of God. And what that tells us is, this is enough. What we've got, right? The word is what it's all about. So you got this from God, and Abraham says, this is all you get, and this is what it is. You're not going to see somebody come back from the dead. And in the end, it wouldn't matter if you did. You either got the kind of heart that is going to believe God's word and do what it says, or you don't. And if you're not going to believe and do what he says from what's written in his word, you wouldn't believe if somebody came back from the dead. That's what Abraham said in this account. That's what Jesus says Abraham said. And if you would believe, then here's what you need. And God says, this is enough. Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is God's power to salvation. The power is in the word. And so we have to trust it, and we have to live by it. And secondly, we have to think, how can I learn the lessons of this rich man in this life? That's what I'll leave you with. Think about this. Number one, you live so that there's no horrible surprise when you wake up on the other side of the grave. You live so those angels come and get you and bring you to paradise. Right? That's number one. Part of that is showing love and concern to your fellow man. Right? Jesus makes that crystal clear in Matthew 25. That a big part of it is you loving your neighbor as yourself. And so learn the lesson of the rich man who neglected this man laying in his gates. Secondly, learn the lesson of the rich man. He realized when it was too late that he wished he could share some truth with his brothers, didn't he? Oh, my brothers are headed here. Can you send him a message? It was too late. But it's not too late for us to think about our brothers and our neighbors and to share the saving message of God. This is it. This is what we got. And so we have now. Because there'll be a time, and I wonder how many people, even now, there's no way to know, are wishing they could send a message to somebody who's still alive. That's sobering to think about, isn't it? How many people right now would say, oh, I wish I could tell them something. I wish I could tell them. What would they tell them if they could tell them? Listen to the word. Right? You've got it. It's a message from God written to people. Listen to this. Don't come where I'm at. And what just an awful thought to even think about. But that's the reality. That's the situation that Jesus describes in this parable. So you have the opportunity now, and we do, to take this word, put it in our hearts, live by it, and we don't even have to worry about ever experiencing torment. If your life is not right and you want to make it right, and if we can help you make it right, if you need to be baptized into Christ, if you need to repent of sins, if you want us to pray for you for your strength or encouragement, if there's anything we can do, and we can do it now, we'd be glad to if you let us know while we stand in